Okay, this is Richard Verona, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Mr. Roy, we were talking around the time of the Battle of Hill 24, where you proceeded over to Hill 668, and we talked a little bit about probably most of that battle and what had happened in the initial stages and into that night. So would you like to pick up there and proceed the narrative from there?
Okay. Battle of what we called 724, mm-hmm. was actually Hill 668, took place on November the 11th, 1967.
Okay.
It was just a few kilometers from the Laotian border, the main Allied base being Dak To, mm-hmm. which was maybe 15 kilometers further east than that, along Highway 14. We had assaulted into a one-ship LZ, gotten over to Hill 668, found the position that our fellow company from 1st Battalion had been in when one of their patrols doing an advance early in the morning down the finger ran into probably one or two North Vietnamese battalions waiting for them. The rest of the company mainly dumped their mortars into their holes, covered them up real quick, and then charged down the hill to help the rest of the unit, the platoon that had gone ahead.
Mm-hmm.
After the earlier battles 4 months earlier, where A Company 2nd Battalion had been wiped out, 173rd and other units, of course, had learned very carefully that you don't just send forces piecemeal into a fight. So this company commander was determined not to make that same mistake,
mm-hmm.
And he just sent everybody down the hill. They were able to hold off the assaults for, 5 hours or so before they were finally able to get us in there. The company commander had been killed. I saw his body laying on a trail. We had overtaken the company, advanced slightly to their front so that they could get organized and get their dead and wounded back up to the top of Hill 668,
mm-hmm.
and establish another defensive perimeter, because our primary concern was that another North Vietnamese unit would swing in behind us, come up on the top of Hill 668, and then attack down,
mm-hmm.
because at this time we were on the side of the hill. Going down from 668. So we engaged the enemy for about an hour while, and I'm not off the top of my head, I think it was B Company, 1st Battalion, was able to withdraw back up to the hill. It was an orderly withdraw. We were attacked maybe three times, drove them off all three times. By this time, of course, we had a lot of fresh troops. B Company had been running out of ammunition, whereas we had plenty, so the firepower we were putting out, the North Vietnamese couldn't face, and we weren't caught by surprise like B Company was.
When you say that you were attacked three times, what do you mean by that? How would they attack you?
Well, they'd assault. The ground sloped down slightly.
Mm-hmm. To your position? To your position or away from you?
Oh, away from us.
Okay, away.
Because we had come down from the old position that the 1st Battalion had mm-hmm. been in mm-hmm. when their advanced platoon had been sent down the hill ahead of them, and then had been hit, and then the rest of their company went down to help them.
Okay.
So they were kind of like on the side of the hill.
Okay.
We had, from where we landed, we went to 668. Went over the top, saw their positions, captured two North Vietnamese in their positions who we assumed were outposts, because they must have heard our helicopters landing such a short distance away.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, two men, of course, aren't going to hold much up. The terrain, this was a finger-like.
Mm-hmm.
It went from 724, there was a little dip-like in a saddle, came up to 668, and then started going down. The terrain on either side of this finger was very precipitous. It would have been very difficult for the North Vietnamese to just swing around the side of this company from 1st Battalion mm-hmm. and enveloped them from behind also. It would have taken a long circuitous route to go down, up, find another finger, and come up from another direction.
Okay.
Who knows? They may have been involved in that at the time. But by the time they saw us coming in, then they realized it was really too late.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually, if not caught in a bad position or too much by surprise, an American rifle company can hold off a North Vietnamese rifle battalion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Our firepower and the like and our discipline was excellent. And we could call in all kinds of artillery support and air support and the like. So anyway, we advanced through 1st Battalion, I think it would be Company 1st Battalion, so that they could, and then took up a line across the finger so that they could regroup and withdraw with their dead and wounded and the like back up top of the hill, cut an LZ so the helicopters could come in and pick up the wounded and then the dead. And then while they were doing that, we were attacked by the enemy coming slightly uphill up the finger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since it was a finger, it was a narrow front, which was not in their interest.
Right.
Because we could concentrate all of our firepower on that narrow front. And since we were on the defensive, we had the advantage. So they attacked, but each time we were able to put out so much firepower that the attack faded very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't, it was very heavily forested. I remember you couldn't see them too well. You'd see them now and then, and when they came under heavy fire, they'd get down rather than well, they couldn't stand up. They'd all been killed, and try and crawl forward,
mm-hmm.
and we'd answer with grenades or keep our rifle and machine gun fire extremely low, and they couldn't get through that either. And they tried that about three times, but they couldn't flank us because the sides of that finger were just so steep and heavily bambooed, which means very thick.
Did you guys question why in the world they were trying to attack up that narrow front and put them at such a, put themselves at such a disadvantage, or was that normal for them to do?
That was normal for them to do. They knew they were going to take very heavy casualties. There's so many times we had great admiration for their bravery, but at the time, also at the same time, we figured it was just kind of stupid
mm-hmm.
because in this day and age of firepower, frontal assaults have to be made only when you've got what I described earlier as fire superiority.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, you're standing up charging, you're finished.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, artillery and airstrikes had been hitting, we'd been calling them in behind the enemy, a little bit further down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
So they were being damaged back down the hill also. But still, they kept trying. Why? I think it was foolish, especially with reinforcements in. They should have known better. Than if we had not gotten there, these attacks would have overrun B Company 1st Battalion.
Right.
There was no doubt about it.
Right.
I've talked to guys from my unit who met some of those guys at one of the 173rd reunions, and to this day they're deeply indebted to C Company, 4th Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we held them off, and then orders came for us to withdraw. So we withdrew similar to the way that you advance on an enemy sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of leapfrogging forward, firing, you leapfrog backwards, firing.
Mm-hmm.
Until you've broken contact. And you've got to be very, very, very careful because that's a prime time to be attacked when you're moving.
Mm-hmm.
But the enemy didn't follow us.
Okay.
And we got back to the point where we realized they weren't following us, and then we just carefully walked backwards instead of leapfrogging.
Mm-hmm.
We got back up to the hill. They set my mainly B Company was allowed to just rest. My company took up most of the perimeter, and my position was facing back down the finger where most of the fighting had taken place. And we spent the night, and there were other hill battles going on in Dokto. They were going on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, no matter where you were and you looked around, you'd see other hills with smoke, airstrikes going in, artillery, stuff like that. So that night, you could see various artillery hitting, sometimes tracer fire coming off of different hills, you know, a few kilometers away. I remember they called in Puff the Magic Dragon, which was the first fixed-wing gunship they had in Vietnam, the C-47 with Gatling guns on it. And I remember watching them working over an area.
I've heard that was a pretty awesome sight.
Yes, that always was. That was quite amazing. Unfortunately, it was the only one I saw. They had two later types of fixed-wing gunships. The next one was known as Spooky, and it was a C-119, and it was a double-tail boom aircraft, actually the type that I had jumped out of in jump school. And it was able to carry more weaponry on it. And then they came up with the one that we still have, known as a Spectre gunship, which was a C-130. And it had a whole bank of not 7.62 millimeter or 30 caliber Gatling guns, but 20 millimeter Gatling guns. Plus it had two 40 millimeter pom-pom guns, and it had a 105 millimeter artillery piece, and they were all computer controlled, and they were incredibly accurate. They were just incredibly accurate. But they operated mainly over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. But I saw C-47s constantly. But it was a quiet night. I think somebody on one side of the perimeter had heard something, but it wasn't much of a probe. If it was a probe, I don't know. We got up the next morning, and I think it was two platoons of my company were to advance back down the finger. We got back just beyond where the heavy fighting had taken place the day before, and we ran into the North Vietnamese. They weren't in tremendous strength, and I think they were a rear guard. They put up a fight. I didn't see. I know, you know, that off to my right, somebody was throwing out smoke grenades to try and mark, you know, the front limits of our advance so that they get helicopter gunship fire ending in. The gunships have to know where we are so they won't hit us. And a North Vietnamese soldier here ran out and jumped on top of the smoke grenade, which was a futile thing to do because you're not going to stop the smoke grenade. Once they're going, they're going. And they're also extremely hot. And he was shot and killed. The smoke continued, but the helicopter gunships couldn't see it. It was dispersed. It was a problem in thick woods, thick jungle, if you want to call it. Smoke would disperse by the time it got to the top of the trees. A little firefight went on for maybe 10 minutes. I didn't see anybody. Most of the firing was off to the right. I fired. We all fired low in our front in case somebody was trying to come up to support the enemy attack on our right, their left flank. I just remember some bullets popping overhead. It was nothing real serious. And then it got quiet. So we advanced further down the right-hand side of the finger. We swung around, and we found lots and lots of enemy equipment covered with blood, very heavily used as far as, you know, foot traffic. People have been milling around. There were a lot of bloody bandages. You could see where things have been dragged off, most likely bodies and wounded. We advanced maybe another 150 meters, and the finger began to level out a little bit. And we came upon what apparently had been their first aid station. And they'd had like a little operating table set up between two trees with limbs tied between the trees to form like a stretcher. And then trying to remember what they had over that, maybe reeds and the like. And it was just covered with bloody bandages everywhere, used medical equipment. It had seen a lot of bloody use, but there was nobody there.
Was this medical equipment antiquated, or was it similar to what you guys had? Or?
Oh well, it wasn't similar to what we had, but it wasn't real primitive.
Okay.
I mean, they did have antibiotics. They did, whenever possible, have quinine, because they suffered terribly from malaria.
Mm-hmm.
Most Allied forces, way out in the jungle, the North Vietnamese were city and small town boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't used to that area either. So like the local populace, they hadn't built up a tolerance to malaria. So they whole regiments would be down, I remember hearing, with malaria. And it's a really terrible, debilitating disease,
mm-hmm.
and it takes a long time to run its course, and it can kill you if it's not treated well.
Mm-hmm.
Each man would, like us, carry a bandage and a little pack, and they had their medics in each platoon, I believe, like us,
mm-hmm.
and then they had company size, and apparently there had been doctors and nurses here.
Okay.
By the way, it was set up. That's what it looked like.
Okay.
Because there were used scalpels. There were, like I said, so many bandages. There were. You had the feeling it was a very well organized little hospital set up.
And they must have evacuated very quickly.
Oh yes.
To leave all that stuff.
There was one body laying on the ground that they didn't have time to take with them. Now they always did their best to extract their dead, as we did too. For two reasons. Number one, they were their buddies, just like us.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they didn't want the enemy to know just how badly they'd been hurt.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't that many bodies around there. We proceeded beyond that, suddenly came under some fire. It's a very quick firefight. Fired a few shots, and it stopped. And we advanced, and me and a fellow soldier, a black guy named Sanford, were next to each other. We went forward and came upon two foxholes, and inside the foxholes were each one had a dead North Vietnamese soldier,
mm-hmm.
and foxholes going in a line further down. And these soldiers had obviously been killed by overhead artillery.
Okay.
And each one had a brand spanking new SKS, which was a communist carbine,
mm-hmm.
10-round carbine. And those type you could take home as a war trophy.
Really?
They weren't automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And Sanford and I grabbed those real quick. And we didn't even have time to check the bodies for intelligence information when I suddenly looked up and I could see about, 70 feet away, some GIs peering through the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out it was another one of our companies coming to that area,
mm-hmm.
which was sweeping from the opposite direction. And they had been in a fight earlier. There was a lot of gunfire going on around, single shots, few shots, short sustained. And these men had apparently run into what was left of this North Vietnamese force retreating, and the North Vietnamese force veered off to one side, left or right, because the finger had started to come down into a valley,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to get down off the sides of the finger. It wasn't as steep.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we waved to them, they waved to us, and we stood there for a few minutes, or knelt there for a few minutes. It was decided that my unit would go back up the finger, except on the opposite side. So we started back up the finger. We started finding a few bodies. We kept going, and suddenly we came to a section of the trail where there was an entire North Vietnamese squad, completely armed, reinforced with a machine gun,
mm-hmm.
and had an RPG man, a rocket launcher,
mm-hmm.
And everybody else had AKs or SKSs, and they were all laying on the trail dead, and obviously an artillery round had hit in the trees just above them,
mm-hmm.
and it killed them all.
Wow.
And they were all still in line.
Wow.
And we got about to the middle of them. I mean, we didn't even pick up their weapons, which kind of surprised me. they didn't let us stop, pick up their weapons, check for any kind of documents or anything, because that's something we always did.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
I'm not sure. I don't know. And the thing is, all of a sudden the company stopped. And so I went in towards the center of the finger, you know, we kind of alternate, so I could face the center in case anybody came from that direction, and some of the other guys went just a few feet down so they could look down the side of the finger.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down, I had my rucksack on. I sat down, no, I didn't have my rucksack on, I'm sorry, I just had all my fighting gear. I left my rucksack back up on top of the hill. I sat down, and I'm facing out, and we're talking, and I'm glancing over at these dead North Vietnamese. And when you sit down in the woods, a lot of times you sit down on rocks or roots or the like.
Mm-hmm.
I was so used to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, just even sleeping on the ground, you just kind of wrap yourself around so you're not laying right on obstructions like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I remember moving around trying to get comfortable on it. And about 5 minutes later, the word came down, okay, get up, we're going to continue. And I got up, and as I pushed myself up on one side with my left arm, I looked down, and there were the tail fins from a mortar round sticking up about an inch or so.
Oh, gosh.
The mortar round had been a dud, and it landed and buried itself except for about an inch of the fins.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, it was a dud, but then again, you know, here I am moving around on it.
Trying to get comfortable on top of it.
Yeah, you know,
wow.
I pointed it out to everybody, and everybody's going, Jesus Christ, Roy, you know, you almost got your ass blown away on that one.
Uh-huh.
So we advanced on, again, left the North Vietnamese. It's possible that the company that we had met at down towards the bottom of the finger
mm-hmm.
had swept further up, and maybe that's why they told, you know, they didn't tell us to take everything. My platoon was the second platoon in the line of advance.
Okay.
And usually the first ones to come upon them, you know, would check all the bodies for things. And we'd always take all the equipment, all the weapons, check for diaries were a very important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, American soldiers were forbidden to write diaries for the same reason. North Vietnamese are very good at that. But you can take that diary and they will list, you know, what direction they had come from, what they had done the day before, if they had gone through a base camp or a weapons cache or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and they were very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept a lot of diaries. A few of us guys did, even though it was technically not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
I wish to God I had. My father had kept a diary during his advance through Europe with General Patton's forces.
Wow.
He was an artilleryman,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know why I didn't, and like many other veterans to this day, I kicked myself.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we advanced right back up to our main position on top of the hill, run into a couple of bodies and equipment and the like. We'd obviously done a hell of a lot of damage. Well, when you're in combat sometimes, you always feel you're on the bad end of the stick,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times after it's over and you sweep through the enemy position, you find out that thank God you were where you were because they were catching it much worse.
Mm-hmm.
So surprisingly, later on that day, the order came down from my company to go out by helicopter. And the company we had relieved was joined by another company from that battalion
mm-hmm.
That had been decimated in another fight to form a full-size company. And we were surprised because we figured they'd pull them out of the field so that, you know, they could mentally anyway get everything back together, replace any lost equipment, stuff like that, you know, reorganize.
Right, right.
And they didn't. They left them in the field, and they pulled us out. And they took us back to what we called Docto 2,
right.
which later on became Ben Het Special Forces Camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there for several days. And I remember my closest friend, his tour was up, and he left. I remember saying goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
my squad had been sent out to support the morning anti-mine and anti-ambush run between Ben Het and the next outpost down the road.
Was that a common thing every morning to do?
Every morning, everywhere. Yeah, the roads are swept.
Can you describe how you would support that?
Usually there'd be a minesweeper team in front, engineers, and in most cases, if possible, and it was possible in this case, there was a tank right behind them. There were about four men off to each side and slightly forward of the minesweeper team, because you had two things to worry about. One, you could be ambushed. Secondly, a common tactic would be to have a command-detonated explosion with a wire. So by these two groups of four men off to the side and ahead, they might run across that wire sooner or scare off the people or run off or kill the people that were waiting to touch the wires to a battery and set off the explosion and kill the mine detector team. But, you know, the enemy was used to us doing that, so didn't do it too often. The main purpose then was just to watch out for regular pressure sons, sensitive mines. And then the convoys could start rolling again with supplies between the different bases on this road. And this was this came off of Highway 14, headed east into Laos. The road petered out right at the border beyond Ben Het to a trail, and I think it was 514, 512, something like that. It's on the map, I know. So we followed it out until we met the mine road clearing team from the next outpost down. We'd meet each other halfway. And then they'd go back to their particular outpost again. But we were ordered to stay at this halfway point because Rome plows had come with them. And these Rome plows were huge D-10 bulldozers, and they cleared away the jungle for at least 100 feet on either side, which made it extremely difficult to ambush a convoy because of the distance and the fact that where the trees are all pushed back, where that line in is where the enemy had to be firing from. So it delineated where the enemy positions most likely were, because in an area we expected to be possibly ambushed, helicopter gunships and the like would fly overhead constantly. So, excuse me. We stopped and set up. One of the tanks stayed with us and took up a position on a little bit of high ground overlooking the whole area. And we set up two-man positions all the way around the area. And these, I believe it was four of these big bulldozers, started their work. And all day long, that's what they did. They just pushed back the jungle, and we'd advance a little further down. They'd push back the jungle more and more. I remember getting bored, and I told the guy next to me, I said, I'm going to take a little walk out into the woods in front of us. And
by yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I signaled over to the two guys I could see, maybe 150 feet away, on either side of us, that I was going out front. Sometimes if you had to go to the bathroom or whatever, you did that, but you always signaled positions on either front you were going out there.
Right.
So I went out. I don't remember being anxious about anything. I was just curious. Wandered around in the jungle. I could hear where the bulldozers were real easy, so I knew which direction to get back at. It was extremely thick. And I just walked around, sat down, just kind of rested, leaned up against a tree thinking and the like, and then worked my way back in. Later on after the war, I kind of wondered why I did such a stupid thing.
At that time, did you just say, well, the hell with the risk, and I just need to walk around?
Well, no, I just didn't feel there was that much risk.
Huh.
I don't know why. Because, again, you know, there was constant artillery firing on hills and airstrikes where there were hill battles going on. But for some reason, I just didn't feel that there was any. Don't ask me why. I don't know. But it was interesting walking around. And like I said, it was extremely dense growth with lots of tangled, big wooden vines and, you know, very, very thick. So I came back in. I was there following my trail. And towards the end of the day, the tank and the bulldozers in us headed back up the road towards Ben Het, because the bulldozers were going to spend the night at Ben Het, again, which was a real big forward outpost, right on the Laotian border. We went back, no problems. While I had gone, my buddy had gone into the rear, which, you know, to leave.
Right.
I knew that.
Right.
And the next day we got orders that we were going to make an assault, a hellebore assault into a certain area. And looking back on it, I think it was just to the north of Ben Het, or just to the northwest a little bit, but maybe about 5 or 6 kilometers. And that's just my remembrance of kind of like which direction the choppers were going in. I could be wrong. But anyway, we all gathered, and we were waiting for the ships. And another company came in, because there was always one company of infantry minimum guarding the base. That duty was known as Palace Guard, because you got to do a little bit of resting. They're constantly running patrols, but, you know, you got a little bit of rest.
Right.
And this company was D Company 1st Battalion, and a close friend of mine from Parachute Infantry Training School, not Jump School, but Airborne Infantry School, was in that unit, and he was a mortarman.
Okay.
His name was Riley. And, in fact, there was another guy named Riley there, and the three of us got real close. Our last names all began with R, and we were real close. Every time we had to stand in line by alphabetical order, you know, we were real close to each other, and we got to know each other, and, you know, during during that training. The other Riley went off to officers training school. I turned it down, and me and this other Riley went to 173rd. Like I said, he was a mortarman, which is infantry trained, mainly infantry, but also with mortar training.
Right.
And I was just straight grunt. And I had heard the day before, I think, or the day before that, that something that happens, and it does happen all the time, that there had been a short round fired by a four-point battalion mortars, 4.2 inch or roughly 120 millimeter, very big mortar, that had landed on top of D Company and incurred about 5 killed and the like.
Okay.
And that happens. You know, it's an accident. It happens. A short round sometimes, the whole charge propelling the round out of the mortar doesn't ignite, so it doesn't go as far as you want it to. And if you're firing over you and it's short, it could land on top of you.
Right.
At the same time, sometimes it could overshoot. Also, sometimes in the heat of battle, a person given the coordinates on the map might give a wrong coordinate, and the stuff lands on top of you. Or, you know, there's lots of reasons the accidents happen. We accepted all that.
Okay.
I mean, shit happens.
Right.
We'd much rather take the few casualties we did to friendly fire than not have that support available.
Right.
Because we'd have lost a lot more men. People in this country, civilians, don't seem to understand that. And they get all upset, and usually they want somebody's head to roll for it. And they just don't understand. It's not gross negligence. But anyway, it happened. We were getting ready to get on the ships, and down on the lower LZ, like I said, D Company first time was coming in. One of the guys, they were coming up the hill, and they were just looking dog tired. And I heard it was D Company, so I went down, and I stopped one guy, and I said, you got a guy in Company Mortars by the name of Riley? And I was looking forward to seeing him again. Hadn't seen him since training. And he kind of looked up at me with totally exhausted, kind of sad eyes, and said, yeah, he was killed the other day, short round, 4-point deuce. And he just looked at me and said, sorry, and then walked on. And I was just totally stunned. I couldn't move for a couple of minutes. Because I'd heard about the incident.
Right.
And I never, of course, connected it with him. And he had a real sad sack story. He had been in the Army before. He'd gotten out. He'd gotten married. He'd gotten into alcohol. Mm-hmm. It had destroyed his marriage. And he realized the only way he was going to get away from the alcohol or his best chance to kind of bring his life back together and possibly keep him going to jail. And he was a real nice guy, but mm-hmm. when he drank too much, he got in trouble. Was to join the Army again. And he realized in training, I mean, you're so tightly controlled, you have no access to alcohol at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'd sit around, he'd tell his story about wife and child and, you know, his wife just would never forgive him or, you know, had found somebody else and, you know.
Was he a bit older than you were?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
I haven't been in the Army for 3 years earlier. I think he'd been out for about 3 years or 4 years maybe.
Okay.
But, you know, he knew what he was getting into. He was very, you know, yeah, I've done this before.
Mm-hmm.
But he's always walking around with a sad sack look. A real quiet guy, and that really shook me up.
Have you visited the wall in Washington?
No.
Okay.
I for some reason have a great reluctance. I try and pinpoint it. You know, is it going to bring back feelings when I see names?
Right.
That I remember. I mean, there's a lot of names I don't remember anymore.
Right.
I can see faces, but I don't remember names. Sometimes I can remember names and I can't put faces to them.
Mm-hmm.
With having been in three different units and having been so long ago, you know, that happens. But I've been to the moving wall once,
mm-hmm.
Which was a very small replica. Looked up a few names and just suddenly felt very disinterested and left.
I asked in reference to Riley if you had seen his name on the wall, but did you see
I saw his name in a book listing all the names because I was looking for some other names a few years ago, especially a guy who was I was probably closest to or second closest. Those two guys I was real close to during my time in Vietnam. One guy I know, the guy I was just talking about that at the end of his tour come up and he'd left the unit.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy during my second tour, I knew he came from Alaska, but I never knew, you know, where he was. And I was looking for his name. I was hoping to God I wouldn't find it, and luckily I didn't.
Right.
But, you know, I looked up Riley. I looked up a few others like Smith and Flattery and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And but I had a chance to go a year ago last May. I went to a reunion for C Company 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion, which I served in
mm-hmm.
my second tour. And they were going to go to the wall, but the bus they were going to have for it, they canceled that, and we had to make our own way over there, but I just didn't want to go, so I left. My sister lives nearby D.C., so I went back over to her place instead.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have this little reluctance somehow. I see these stories or these pictures of guys standing there crying.
Right.
And I wouldn't stand there and cry. And I'm not that emotional a person because
mm-hmm.
of some of the problems that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
And I look upon it, I kind of wonder just how real the tears are. Maybe I shouldn't be the one to judge that. But me, I stand there and heavily contemplate, but I wouldn't get that emotional. And I definitely wouldn't go down dressed in all kinds of Vietnam paraphernalia
right.
and the like.
Right.
As much as I am still in Vietnam and wish to God I was back there again. And, you know, I'm not the type to get overly flashy about it.
Right.
There was one short period in my life, but then... I got out of that. Anyway, I didn't go, and I haven't been.
Let me ask you about something you just said. Why do you say that you wish to God you were back there in Vietnam?
I when I got back from my third tour, when I was on leave between tours, you get a special leave back to the States if you volunteer
right.
for an extra tour. I knew I was going back. It was exciting. The country was changing an awful lot. The big hippie movements were in. It was very exciting to come back. But I always knew I'm just back for 30 days.
Right.
And, you know, and again, one foot was always back there. I was always, you know, looking around, being cautious, feeling uncomfortable, sleeping inside a building without knowing there's somebody outside pulling guard. But it was like a different world because this country changed so much since I'd been there.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I had gone from Fort Huachuca, Arizona, with my father up to Alaska.
Right.
And Alaska was like an overseas stint at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Alaska, I flew over to Germany to join my mother and my stepfather, and that was
mm-hmm.
definitely overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I joined the Army there and came back, went straight into training. And you're in another world when you're in training, and then from training after 30-day leave, went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the country had just changed from what I had known it to be. I mean, it was like the Beach Boy kind of era and the like when I had left. People starting to wear narrow jackets and things like that, and the Beatles just starting. And when I came back, it was into this hippie psychedelic kind of thing.
Right.
Which was fascinating to me. And the music was great and everything, because we weren't allowed to listen to radios in the field.
Right.
You couldn't, you know, it makes noise.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back the last time, I got back, and number one, I told you I started to see some disintegration of morale there. I got back, and we'd always heard about, you know, any war protests and the like, and these accusations that were exaggerated and weren't true, and people not knowing exactly what the communists were like and what they were doing and
mm-hmm.
or not caring. I got back, and I really ran into a lot of hostility. I got back, Jesus, a month or so before the My Lai affair broke.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back, I found in that first 30 days, I wasn't a part of what was going on around me. It was very difficult to suddenly make friends.
Mm-hmm.
I had one guy that I had known earlier in Germany. His father had been transferred to Fort Devon, so I knew him. And I found that I was real heavily into this mode of, no matter where I was, in a car or whatever, always looking for an area where you might get ambushed from. I was very uncomfortable
mm-hmm.
Inside of a building. There were woods around my parents' house at the time. Mm-hmm. I used to go out into the woods an awful lot, but I felt naked without a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt so alienated. And finally I went to talk to a priest. I was very religious at the time, Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an awful lot also to the saying that there are very few atheists in the foxholes. I've seen guys that were like gang members in Philadelphia
mm-hmm.
Getting extremely religious in Vietnam. I went to talk to a priest. And he said, I think you got some serious problems here. At the time, too, there was an attitude, Vietnam veterans, especially combat troops, you know, the My Lai thing and the like, that
mm-hmm.
you were probably kind of dangerous, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent me to this psychiatrist, Ernest John Steinhilber III, in Concord, Mass.
Okay.
And, boy, you can't get a more expensive kind of psychiatrist back then.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had once been an Army psychiatrist before the war. I was in private practice now. And I'd sit and talk to him, and it just didn't go anywhere. I mean, I didn't quite know what to say, and he really wasn't very encouraging. He wasn't a very good therapist, I didn't feel.
Mm-hmm.
And then he fell asleep on me once, and I walked out and
Jeez.
Never went back. After that, I went to a community mental health center in Lowell, again, just feeling so alienated, and everybody was, I was fascinated with the the culture,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't seem to make myself part of it. And then people would bring up Vietnam
mm-hmm.
in this negative way. And the only non-negative thing I saw, and like I said, the William Kelly affair was in full swing,
mm-hmm.
were signs or things written on trees, you know, support Kelly, he was only following orders. Well, to me, that's the Nuremberg defense.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Kelly, I know Kelly did what he did, and I'd probably to this day pay money to be on his firing squad.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not standard operating procedure
mm-hmm.
by any means. But we all got blamed for it. And I remember a little bit later on, you know, this girl, when I'd gotten into college under the GI Bill, you know, she knew I'd been in Vietnam, and I wanted to talk to somebody about it.
Mm-hmm.
But other guys that had come back and had already learned, keep your mouth shut, weren't saying they'd been in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there were a lot of them around me, I never knew who they were. And I'd start to talk about some things, and you know, it upset her, and finally she came out and said, you know, well, look, I knew what you guys were doing. I mean, I'm just following this William Kelly thing.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to explain, no, that was not what we did. And she kind of broke it off. Anyway, from the Community Mental Health Center, this guy says, I think you better check yourself into the state hospital in Gardner, Mass., which doesn't exist anymore. It's a medium security prison now.
Okay.
But the way they ran mental hospitals back then, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, sir.
I'm telling you, that is just so familiar to me. Anytime I've seen that movie, they didn't do the lobotomy kind of thing.
Okay.
But back then, it was to a great degree, it was very good
mm-hmm.
because all these street people that you see and the like, you know, they can even get money from the government enough to live on, get a place to live well. They've got mental problems,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they should be, for their own sake, in a state hospital where they can be watched so they won't be taken advantage of. They won't, you know, die from not knowing how to take care of themselves. They're mentally ill. But at the same time, a lot of people were sent there who weren't mentally ill. Now, with me, it should have been recognized because from the Civil War, if you ever really studied PTSD, from the Civil War, the post-war facts are just filled with people like me and like others.
Mm-hmm.
Can't adjust back from the war. And it was very common. I remember reading, after the First World War, they called it shell shock.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book by Dalton Trumbo, and he talked about back during the 30s and the like, that all the drunks in the gutters and the streets and the like were all World War One combat veterans.
Mm-hmm.
After the Second World War, they had the problem, but when they came back, that was an extremely popular war, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was a hero. And it was a little bit better, but still they had guys with a lot of problems, but they kept it to themselves. And the statistics, when they're read, show that, yes, there were an awful lot of guys with very serious problems. The Korean War had the same thing. Had less for some reason than most other wars.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know why. And then Vietnam, and when you come out of combat and then you run into something negative at the same time, well, that makes it even worse.
Mm-hmm.
What was I going to say here? This book that I read was really fascinating. And I had talked to a psychiatrist once, it's Dr. Emery at the VA hospital up here,
mm-hmm.
about that issue. And I said, I don't understand. When I came back and they saw these symptoms and the like, why didn't they recognize them? And instead of telling me you're sick and the like,
mm-hmm.
why didn't they tell me, well, of course you feel this way. You just came out of combat.
Right.
And he said, you know, unfortunately, there's too much length of time between major wars, and every lesson that's learned, by then the psychiatrist who had learned the lesson
mm-hmm.
were retired,
mm-hmm.
and a new batch had come in, and even though the literature was there, they didn't have the direct one-to-one experience with veterans, and they didn't quite know how to deal with it.
Okay.
And I thought about that, and, you know, and in a way, I agree with them, but in a way, it's hard to say it's too bad there's too many years between major wars. Major wars are horrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't believe in this Iraq thing
mm-hmm.
unless something extremely, extremely significant is found. Because the people who want to send these folks off into war, well, they didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not thinking about what they're doing. I mean, not just our troops, but, you know, civilians will get caught in the middle. They always do.
Of course.
And there's a lot of other reasons, too, including the money.
Mm-hmm.
But
we can talk about that later when we get to the...
So anyway, I was in Gardner State Hospital for about a month, and it was just a warehousing situation.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, anybody caught with any kind of drugs, marijuana included, kids were sent up there for 30 days observation. Well, there was nothing wrong with them either. There were kids experimenting with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
There were some guys up there that had multiple sclerosis or something from early on, which was diagnosed as a mental disease, and they were warehoused there. So I'd say approximately 20% should not have been there, including me.
Mm-hmm.
The rest were definitely very mentally ill people that had to be cared for. And the therapy mainly consisted of giving you this medication for the first 3 days, and I don't even remember my first 3 days. And I remember the irony of earlier and later on them saying, "Are you on drugs?" And then they just drugged me out for the first 3 days I was there
mm-hmm.
and locked me up. So when I got out and I got into the general population, you know, the people, the 20% that there was nothing really wrong with who were, quote-unquote, normal, kind of helped take care of the 80% that, you know, were along with the attendants.
Mm-hmm.
They assigned me to see a therapist for 15 minutes a day, and wouldn't you know, this therapist was an extremely attractive Asian woman.
Okay.
The fact she was a woman was one thing. I had lost contact with my ability to deal with women. The fact she was very attractive certainly didn't help.
Mm-hmm.
The Asian thing didn't bother me a lot, but I thought it was kind of ironic. And that was basically it. And you had to earn privileges to get out of locked wards and all this other bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I just signed myself out because I hadn't been committed. I could sign out. And my parents had applied to the VA to have me go to Bedford VA Hospital,
mm-hmm.
thinking, well, these people, they know the issue. And I agreed, so I signed out of there, Gardner, went to Bedford, and ran into the same damn thing again.
Hmm.
And finally got fed up after a month there because nothing was happening. They gave me all kinds of psychological tests, Rorschach, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to, the therapist left the room, and I happened to, you know, he was writing everything down. So I reached over and I turned around the folder, and it was listed as neurotic, depressive, possible danger to self and others.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I have no idea why he could possibly list me as a danger to others.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly myself, though I wasn't in the depression that I suffer from in the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I had never expressed any kind of anger towards anybody except maybe the North Vietnamese.
Right.
And I wasn't about to run into any of them mm-hmm. anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
I got fed up with all that, checked out. Got a little bit finally involved in society, but still always feeling a difference, and gradually over a period of 4 or 5 years started withdrawing a little bit more and a little bit more. I was always able to hold a job early on, relatively low paying. I changed jobs a lot. After I got out of the VA hospital, I went to school at Mount Wachusett Community College.
Mm-hmm.
Ran very heavily into the anti-war thing. Met this girl I was telling you about, ran into that, and ran into some people. Some people can be very vicious, and they were a minority, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like I said earlier, the loud minority was very loud, and the silent majority was very silent.
Mm-hmm.
The little snide comments a lot, and then one day, I was sitting there, I was finishing up some writing at the end of the class, and I reached down to get my books under the chair, and the books were gone.
Really?
And that's when I just said, that's it. Because I knew the guy behind me. I was always getting snide comments from him.
He
and that was
books.
It. I just said, fuck it.
Yeah.
So I left, went out, got a job in a molding shop, and generally worked my way up a little bit to better and better molding shops. In 1982, when the wall was built and finally there, people started recognizing Vietnam veterans, I ran across the first vet centers. And I went in. I was married at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't marry for the proper reasons. I married because I felt I was getting older. I was about 30 then.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife went in. And my wife, I've got to say, she really threw herself into it, more than I did. But they talked me into marching in the Veterans Day Parade, I think it was, or Memorial Day, or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And as the it was in order of wars,
mm-hmm.
and ours had been the last one. And some guys gave me a Vietnam shirt, like we wore in Vietnam and the like. And I remember when we came along, all of a sudden, everybody started cheering. And well, what had happened was these were the wives and families, and some of the attitudes had changed a little bit. And I was really stunned by the whole thing. I was very touched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got a little choked up at the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up at the end of the common in town, and this is in Fitchburg, Mass., where they did the final ceremonies and the flag. And I'll be damned if in the front page the next day I was included in the picture,
mm-hmm.
looking at them lowering the flag or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working for Foster Grant at the time, and a lot of people recognized me. And it's then that guys that have been in Vietnam started mentioning, I've been in Vietnam, and I was stunned at the number of people around me who had been in Vietnam and had even been combat soldiers,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, Jesus, finally found a few people to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it was always on my mind. It was, anyway, we're digressing away from Vietnam, aren't we?
Well, we are, and that's okay, though, because this is all stuff that we need to cover, and I'd like for you to talk about as much as you want to.
Yeah.
I did ask you, you said you always wanted to go back.
I would rather be back. I mean, the stark terror of being in situations, and I mean, it is stark terror. I have never been before or since in situations of stark terror like that. But at least I felt a solid part of a group, a valued member, and like I've talked about in Vietnam combat veteran groups, and we've all agreed in therapy, you had mainly one problem,
mm-hmm.
okay? It was a big problem, but it was one problem. And you knew there was somebody next to you who had that same problem, and you could depend upon them to help, usually,
mm-hmm.
always. But you could take a very decisive action against that problem.
Right.
You had weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty easy to identify what the problem was. You get back into life here, and suddenly you're in a society where it isn't so heavily bound together by this external threat, and you don't feel that much of a member, and you've got problems coming at you from every direction. They're not as big, but there's a million of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the time I spent there during these developmental years, the end of my developmental years from 18 to a little bit past 21, there's a lot I think I missed. Women especially I lost contact with. I'd gotten a Dear John during my second tour,
mm-hmm.
From a girl I'd known before or when I went in, and then running into this girl afterwards too, you know. But
mm-hmm.
I then I started realizing, you know, people really didn't understand what had happened over there. It always has a negative connotation anytime.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about Vietnam. Vietnam is always the tragedy of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it didn't have to end that way. It ended very sordidly with us betraying the South Vietnamese terribly. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't feel part of a group again, and I felt unarmed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could deal with some situations, but not as decisively as I could in Vietnam.
Right.
Because I was a combat soldier all the time. Mm-hmm. I would always like to have a weapon. I would love to have an AR-15, but I won't let myself have weapons. Because first thing is, after having seen all the accidents that I saw when everybody's walking around carrying weapons and enough pyrotechnics to wipe out this little town that I live in,
mm-hmm.
I mean, accidents happen.
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do is read the paper, and oh my God, they're just constantly happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that. And in the last 8 years, there have been times when I have been just so depressed and feeling so hopeless that I just, you know, wouldn't want a weapon around.
Right.
I also think if I ever caught somebody breaking into this house, I'd overreact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would shoot. I would shoot the way I was taught to shoot,
mm-hmm.
and you shoot for center of mass and you fire three times,
mm-hmm.
Which could probably be construed as excessive force in many cases. So I'm not worried about my anger. My anger I keep inside too much. So I'm not worried about getting angry and grabbing my gun and going outside and shooting somebody.
Right.
Or even if I was living with somebody, I would never do that. But, the accidents especially.
Right.
If there's no reason to have a gun, and there's no reason for so many guns being around, but, people got them everywhere. I just rather not have them. When I was house-sitting for a friend for almost 3 years in an old 200-year-old farmhouse in Ocam.
Mm-hmm.
He was my closest friend at the time. He hadn't been in Vietnam. And he got into guns. And he had an AR-15. And instead of keeping it at his girlfriend's house where he was living, he kept it at this house that he owned, but where I was house-sitting for him. And there are times I would take that weapon out, always clear it, make sure it never was loaded. And for me to sit there and just to have that weapon across my lap or leaning up against the chair,
mm-hmm.
I emotionally am suddenly feeling much more calm, much more relaxed. It's interesting that 2 days ago I went in to see the therapist, one of the therapists I'm seeing,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of her veterans give her things, and she had one of them had given her one of these grenades, M26 grenades that they're not really grenades there, but they weigh just the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her, to hold. I remember holding that thing during the whole 1 hour meeting, and holding it like you'd hold it just before you threw it, and just unconsciously, mm-hmm. Feeling better, which makes me feel sick in a way, but in the same token, I understand psychologically what it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Why do you think that you do feel that comfort and that kind of?
Because
peace?
That was the way during that period that I had of protecting myself, of dealing
right.
with threats.
Right.
What the hell? I hear sounds.
Mm-hmm.
When I get in a threatening position, not serious bodily threatening, it's just emotionally threatening for
mm-hmm.
one thing or another,
mm-hmm.
especially around attractive women. I hear rifle fire, I hear machine gun fire, I hear explosions. It's not psychotic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I know where I am, I know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And like I've had it explained to me, there's two different types of flashbacks. One flashback is the one that a lot of people know of, and it's psychotic. You really think you're back in a situation, and I've never had anything like that.
Right.
And this was explained to me by a psychiatrist who'd come from Estonia. And as a girl in Riga, they had the Germans go through, and then the Russians come back through, and there were bombers constantly. And she explained, she said, the other type of flashback is what's known as an intrusion. And that's where something during a very significant time of your life comes back into your mind, some a sound or a feeling, and you know where you are, and you're interacting, but this thing is there, and it's a little distracting. She said, it happens to me.
Mm-hmm.
She'll hear large 2- or 4-engine heavy aircraft, and she'll hear them when she gets into a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if she hears a real one, you know, that brings her even more. But still, she's not psychotic. She knows where she is. She knows, you know. And she explained, this is what you're feeling. And I felt much better after having that explained.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens quite often.
Did you ever try to explain that to anyone else besides a therapist, one of your buddies?
No.
Okay.
Too many people would tend to see it as psychotic.
Right.
And I call them my machine gun sounds, because most often it's an M60 machine gun, which is, of course, the most important, powerful weapon in a squad.
Mm-hmm.
And
I believe one of the pictures you sent me, you were holding one, weren't you?
Excuse me?
You're holding one of the M60s, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. I was a gunner at that time.
Yes.
I'd been a grunt gunner, which means an infantry machine gunner, mm-hmm. twice. And then my second tour, I was a door gunner in a helicopter firing another model of the same machine gun,
mm-hmm.
another version, a variant.
Right.
So I'm very familiar. It's about 550 rounds per minute,
mm-hmm.
Cycle of fire. Almost the same as a Huey helicopter rotor blade, kind of a bop, 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 bop.
Right.
And those sounds, those feelings come back to me, too. I don't hear Hueys as much as I used to, but anyway, there's lots of things that, and if I'd had somebody to talk to, somebody who knew what I was talking about, and just had somebody to talk to at all, when I withdrew, and you don't have people to talk to bounce your feelings off, your imagination can get carried away with yourself. You can begin to feel I'm abnormal, the withdrawal and the like hurt me a lot, and still does. I live alone.
Mm-hmm.
Desperately want a relationship, but I'm frightened of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Can
I ask you about those? You mentioned those two guys you did get close to in Vietnam, one of them who left in that first tour we've talked about, and then Riley, who was killed. I'm sure there are a couple of other guys that you got to know fairly well.
There's a couple of them. There's a few of them I found again. The one I told you I was looking for his name in the book,
mm-hmm.
The other one I was very close to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I finally, thanks to the Internet, I finally found him. And I remember the night about 2.5 years ago I found him. And we are very, very, very close. He's in Alaska, Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here. We knew each other for only 5 months, but he had a great, great, great influence in my way of thinking. I was extremely conservative before I met him.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that got me to start questioning certain things,
mm-hmm.
instead of just accepting them at face value. And Rod Darnell's his name.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to get up and see him sometime. I had been in Alaska with my father, as I'd said earlier, and that's the first thing that brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Alaska. Oh, I lived in Alaska, too, you know.
Right,
so.
Right.
But there are guys from all three units that were with me in, well, these battles I told you about here, I've just been talking to you about.
Mm-hmm.
There are there's units down to company level that still get together, like C Company, 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion. My third tour was 327th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st. And then the 173rd is the whole brigade kind of thing. But I talk with these guys all the time. And we're always confirming with each other, do you remember this guy's name or do you remember this battle? And we'll talk on the phone like this, and we'll talk in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
You remember this? You remember that? And dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and, you know. And it has been such a tremendous help. Thank God for the Internet. The last 2 years, I mean, I don't see these guys very often. I've only met face-to-face with two of them, but I'll talk on a weekly basis, usually with at least three of them. And I've got to meet them again face-to-face. Mm-hmm. But there were just so many things. It's just been so healthy.
That's what I was going to ask you. When you got back, and then I guess those intervening years between then and when you were able to make contact again, and you said you needed someone to talk to, did you try to search out these guys at that point?
I didn't quite know where to go to find them.
Right.
You know, some of them I knew what state they were from,
mm-hmm.
and a few I knew what city or town they were from, but I didn't quite know how to find them. Sometimes it's hard to get a phone book from rural South Carolina.
Right.
Like for this one guy and the like, but it was the internet. And I remember going on a search engine and just typing in the unit,
mm-hmm.
and being totally stunned that at that time already, different units were pulling together. Guys were making contact and forming associations and groups and get-togethers every year. I've been to two get-togethers already. I'm going to another one later on this year.
That's great.
So I'll have had at least one to get together with each of the three units.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, having served with three units, I can't afford to go to three reunions a year.
Right.
But, you know, I'm going to make, before I die, I'll make three of each one at least, mm-hmm. you know. The one I served with, the helicopter company, I did meet guys that I had known, and we were able to clarify some things to each other about what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
In certain situations, and it's there's an awful lot of them. There really is, all kinds of units, combat units, non-combat units, all branches of the service. There's tons of them out there.
Mm-hmm.
So
we make an effort here at the archive to be in touch with as many units as we can. Actually,
oh yeah,
so we're familiar with that. The problems that you had, the PTSD. Did they seem to get worse as you got older, or were they more acute in your 20s after you got out?
No, they came on slowly. I figured I was going to overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
They just go away. But the therapist mainly didn't understand a lot of it.
Right.
The vet centers were the first ones to really try and deal straight on with it. But a lot of it was run by people who weren't professional therapists. There was a lot of fighting with the government. The VA was not very helpful at all back then. They can still be a royal pain in the ass now.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember I had come back about 6 months after I got back from Vietnam. I got tremendously sick. And what it was malaria that I had several times in Vietnam, but since I wasn't on the medication anymore, it came out as a full-blown malaria attack.
Mm-hmm.
Well, local doctors, they don't see it. And you have to take the blood test during the attack. By the time I got to a doctor, the attack was starting to end. I remember I had an attack twice at this job I just started. And a lot of times, first thing the doctors would say, and I got so tired of hearing it, are you on drugs? Are you on drugs, kid? You know.
That would be the first question?
Yeah.
One of their first questions?
Yeah. And it's a horrible thing to go through those attacks. But finally, one doctor I went to, he said, high temperature, and I can see you got some jaundice in your eyes, heavy vomiting, you know, and the rest of the symptoms. And he said, in medical school, that's what they described to us as malaria. And he'd asked, he noticed this large scar in my back where I'd been wounded the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, how'd you get hurt here? And I told him. And that's when he started thinking, gee, you just came from Vietnam 6 months ago, huh? And he says, I think you better go to the VA hospital. He said, those people, if anybody, it sounds like malaria. So my sister took me to the VA hospital in Jamaica Plain in Boston that night. And the doctor there said, gee, it almost kind of looks like it. He says, especially since I can see some jaundice in your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, surprisingly, the only person who suspected it was my mother.
Really?
Yeah, I had no idea what it was. It's started out, I thought it was the flu or something.
Right.
But so the next, they put me in the hospital, and there's a little bell by the bed, and they said, if you start to feel this attack coming on, you ring that bell right away. And when I did that, then they take the blood test during the attack. Well, the next day, it started. It was every other day. You could almost set your watch to it about 9, 10 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it started. I rang the bell. They came in. They took blood as it was really getting going. And I went through the attack. And afterwards, you're laying there just so totally exhausted you can't move. Doctor came in and said, well, we verified it. It's 5-ax malaria. So they kept me in the hospital for 11 days, put me on very heavy anti-malarial medications. They had to force feed me just mm-hmm. about because you lose all your hunger during a malaria attack. You don't want to eat.
Right.
And a nurse would actually come in with the food and, you know, either I'm going to feed you like a little kid mm-hmm. or we're going to put tube down your stomach. She would literally feed me because if you don't eat, then your body, your immune system can't gear up to fight the malaria along with the medication.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I ended up eating, and over a period of time got better, but it takes about 30 days to get your strength back completely.
What kind of medication did they give you? Did they have Lyrium at this time?
Yeah, in Vietnam, every Monday, everybody took, in Vietnam, took this great big orange horse pill.
Mm-hmm.
And in Vietnam, you never knew what day it was, especially if you were combat. You never knew what day it was or what the date was. You might have an idea as to the month.
Mm-hmm.
But you knew when a Monday was, because the medics had come around with this big orange horse pill.
Mm-hmm.
When you got up into the Central Highlands, and especially combat troops, then you had to take the big orange pill, and then a little white pill every day called Dapsone,
mm-hmm.
and it was in a little aluminum folder like, and they'd rip it open. And the medic, as every time the medic would stand there, you had to put it on your tongue. Swallow it, and you had to open your mouth so mm-hmm. he could see that you took it.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, it was an Article 15 offense if you didn't.
Hmm.
In the Central Highlands, there's a lot more malaria than the rest of Vietnam because mm-hmm. of the mountains. Down in between the hills and the mountains, you have standing water, which breeds mosquitoes and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They also have the other type of malaria, three or four types, but they have the most serious type, which is called falciparum malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And it can kill you, definitely. It affects the brain. It causes the brain to swell. you were supposed to, they gave you these medications when you came back, and you were supposed to take them for 6 weeks. Well, 99.999% of us just threw them away.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, the medication had made sure guys didn't get exposed, but I was exposed, and when my immune system fell because of a cold, it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they confirmed it. And I remember they said, you know, go in and apply for disability. You get a year's disability, 100%, because you lost your new job because of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in, and I'm facing this bureaucrat, and I said, you know, well, here's the documentation from the hospital. I had malaria. And he glances at it, and he says, well, how do I know you didn't get it here? Well, that's one of those questions you sit there and you don't quite know how to answer,
uh-huh.
you know. And so I said, well, how much malaria do you hear of Massachusetts in the winter?
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the winter. This mm-hmm. was like January, February. And he kind of considered that for a minute. And he said, okay, I'll make a judgment on it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the attitude a lot of times of the VA. And they had forgotten, again, a lot of the lessons learned in earlier wars.
Mm-hmm.
And most Vietnam veterans have this saying that the VA is their most favorite government bureaucracy, and that's said very tongue-in-cheek.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
I've dealt with the IRS a lot easier than I've dealt with the VA.
Wow.
But that's not to say they're all that way.
Right.
Okay? They've made some changes and the like. And I have three disabilities. I have the PTSD for 100%. I have 10% for the back wound, which causes me to fidget a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge scar. It goes up against my spine. And then I have 10% for herbal Agent Orange caused diabetes.
Okay.
I don't know if you know about that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So I have actually about 120%. And then I have the malaria one is domestic unless dormant unless I get it again.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you have any regrets about volunteering to go to Vietnam and looking at your health now with this 120% disability?
Oh, well, you know, considering the way it came out.
I know that's hindsight.
Yeah.
But
the way it came out, I wouldn't have had the PSD issues most likely. I mean, it can come from several different types of things,
mm-hmm.
but I wouldn't have had this. I don't think I've lost as much contact with society and women and the like. I probably would have started a job. I would have gone to college. You know, I wouldn't have. I ended up going to college. I ended up with a degree in business and business management and a minor in psych, mainly organizational psych, and a certificate in computer information systems. But I left college after, right after I got back, and then I started up again about 10 years later.
Okay.
And have found that going to school when you're older, you learn a lot more. But but the diabetes, it's onset, it's under control, but there are still symptoms that are it's a pain in the neck.
Mm-hmm.
The fidgeting and the like, the wound probably would not bother me as much if I wasn't as tensed up as I am a lot. And I have to take, they've got me on so many medications. I'm on Social Security also.
Mm-hmm.
And when Social Security, they just looked at the medications they had me on. And they said, Jesus Christ, you shouldn't be working at all with these medications, much less your other symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the only antidepressant that works well is an old one. But it has very serious side effects if you eat certain foods,
mm-hmm.
like cheese or red wine or certain things,
mm-hmm.
or if you if you take other medications. With Demerol, there's only one side effect, and that's death.
Right.
With other medications, death is possible, or other serious injury, and I have to be very careful of it. It's the only one that seems to do anything, and that's limited. Living alone, I might not be living alone, and because that's doing an awful lot to me right there.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the new house, it has helped an awful lot, though. The last couple of days I've been just a little unmotivated. I don't know why,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's a normal. I've heard people talk about that. You know, something you always wanted, you know, and you finally get it, and suddenly there's this little letdown period. So I think that's a normal
mm-hmm.
thing there.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
But I feel kind of good because, you know, well, it's finally happened. I got the house and the like.
Mm-hmm.
I was estranged from my daughter for years, and I don't know why. It was something with her, and her mother couldn't control her. After we separated, and I was living at this house in Ocam that I was house sitting at, so I took her,
mm-hmm.
and her mother never, no discipline, no nothing, and I put a little bit of discipline, nothing serious. Explain, I knew exactly how to handle it, and I handled it really well, but still she was very very rebellious, and her mother, she made this phony suicide attempt with 3 Tylenol,
mm-hmm.
and her mother panicked. The doctors knew what it was and ignored her, basically, in the emergency room. But her mother panicked, and her mother, being the mother, has the right to take her back anytime she wants. And the state told me, because it has to go before the state, and they said, you know, we think you're doing the right thing, but in order to get control of her from her mother, you'd have to come up with something so horrible that her mother did, and it would probably cost you $20,000 for a 1% chance of gaining custody.
Right.
So they'd say, we think you're doing it the right way, but the way the laws are set up, forget it. And ever since then, she was, you know, she wouldn't talk to me anymore. She wouldn't do anything. And I think it's because somebody tried to exert some control over her. And this was about age 12, until just recently. And all of a sudden, she has matured, and I'm very proud of her now. She's, oh, God. And that's been a very, very positive, because I felt I'd lost my daughter. And that's been very positive. I've got the group that I'm in, and those are my only friends right now, but I've got a group. I'm in a lot of therapy, which is a pain in the neck, having to go in three or four times a week. Plus there's other medications besides the one I told you about I'm on. But, you know, but if I don't have them, well, I've got to have them.
Right.
So, in that sense, yeah, I wish I hadn't gone. And the fact that it ended the way that it did. Like I said, it was just, we betrayed those poor people. And the fact of the matter is, we were winning all along.
Do you carry guilt?
I carry guilt for my whole country. I'm in contact with a few South Vietnamese in this country. They don't blame us. They blame themselves. And I'm always telling them, you know, listen, you can't take an army that has no heritage and is brand new and create a good army overnight. They needed several years to get officers trained very well, like we do ours. The North Vietnamese always had a very good army fighting the French. So the South Vietnamese were just at such a disadvantage. And by the time they started coming around, is about the time we cut them off. And that was about 3 years before the end, 1972. South Vietnamese army really started to come along. And there always were good South Vietnamese units. But it takes time to build an army.
Right.
And then we cut them off. No beans, no bullets, no fuel, no nothing. And that's it. They were finished. So, but there's an awful lot of them in this country. Laotians, when I was a production supervisor at different plants, I get along with Southeast Asians very well. I had Laotians working for me, mainly at one place. I had Vietnamese working for me, maybe at another. And mainly at the last place was that I had Khmers or Cambodians, and they're all refugees. And as a group, Cambodians are the worst off emotionally.
Okay.
I've never seen such a horribly depressed group of people in my life, the older ones, who saw the killing fields.
Right.
South Vietnamese, they just want to make a start over. They're usually very appreciative of what the Americans tried. They hate the North Vietnamese. Most of them can never go back, so they send money back. The Laotians were basically relatively primitive, not as much as the Montagnard people, the hill peoples, but they suffered a lot, too. They had to get away from the communists when they took over. The communists were very vindictive and very brutal when they took over. I just get along very well with Southeast Asians to the point sometimes that I've been accused of racism by Americans.
Showing too much favoritism?
Right. The thing is that I just understand them. I understand Southeast Asians more. And I also lived in Turkey. I lived in Germany. I understand foreigners a lot more. I accept foreigners more than a lot of people. And the vast majority of the accusations I had were basically racism on the part of those people. Because it wasn't just Southeast Asians. I mean, they were always complaining about Latinos or people from India or, you know. There's a lot of that around.
Well, you said that your travels and living in these different countries helped you prepare for being around the indigenous people in Vietnam when you were there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I expected to see a difference. And it didn't surprise me that there was a difference. And I started... Just like I realized in Turkey, Germany's not too different from the United States, but it is different. you know, I realized that there were cultural differences, but human beings are still basically human beings. So I expected to see different things, whereas a lot of guys didn't. And they didn't stop and think about why these things were different. whereas having run into them before and expected them, I would kind of try and figure out, you know, well, why is it this way? And usually could. You know, it's if you give somebody half a chance, and you're friendly and the like, you find out they're very much like you.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people have never run into foreigners or people that are very different from them, fear them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of a natural thing because I think in every society there seems to be a certain element of people that fear people that are different from them.
Right.
I mean, there are bigotries and biases in all cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know. But I always, you know, in different parts of Vietnam, there are different types of people.
Right.
Even in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it always fascinating.
You mentioned your spiritual beliefs when you were in Vietnam and then afterwards. How much effect did the war have on your spiritual beliefs on religion?
Ended up killing it. After I got back, I mean, in Vietnam I was very religious. I remember making promises I'd make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and everything. If you just get me through this one battle alive. But when I got back and I started having these problems, I turned very deeply to religion, and, you know, things just got worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
This one person I talked about, Rod Darnell, who made me start questioning things,
mm-hmm.
He always questioned religion. We talked about it a lot, and he planted this little grain of doubt. I still stayed very religious. He and I used to argue in a friendly way, and we still do.
Mm-hmm.
We die for each other, I think, you know, but we're always debating things.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely liberal, whereas I'm moderate with probably liberal leanings.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw things just getting worse and worse, no matter how deeply I got into the religious thing, I gave up. As I am right now, I'd say I'm agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be just for the sake of an insurance policy, you know. So,
right. Tell me a little bit about religion in the field, what it was like.
Well, we all had our little missals. The army issued little things for Catholics and for Protestants and for Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Jews had a little Torah given to them. Protestants had the Old Testament. We had the Catholic Missal. And I think I still have my rosary, which was made up of OD-colored thick or string with knots for each step on the rosary.
Oh, really?
And a plastic. And I still have that, I believe.
Wow.
I might still have my missal also. There was also a medal for Catholics, and it was, Mary, Mother of Paratroopers, guard us in battle or something like that, save us in battle. And it shows the Virgin Mary, and then there's a parachute with a guy in it landing or falling, you know, in a parachute.
They
made priests, pastors, rabbis available as much as possible. And our priests, like giving, when we were at a fire base or something where they'd give a mass, their vestments were all camouflage. They didn't wear the traditional white and black and the like.
Right.
They wore camouflage.
Right.
My battalion priest, Father Waters, was killed in action on Hill 875. In fact, won the Medal of Honor. I believe there's another priest that also won the Medal of Honor and was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Father Waters, on Hill 875, I mean, it was so bad. Father Waters came in along with a full surgical team because it was a five-day-long battle. And I remember I was going up the hill. I'd been taken off the line to carry wounded down and to carry supplies up for a period.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember passing, I looked up, and I saw Father Waters. And all of us, Catholic or Protestant, everybody reached out to touch him as he walked by as if there was something magical that might protect you, you
wow.
know,
wow.
by touching him.
Right.
And feeling a little bit better. And then later on, I don't know if it was later on that day or the next day, a man had been mortally wounded, and he was given the last rites when a mortar round landed next to him and killed him.
Mm.
got to, I mean, the priest couldn't come out to a company-sized position.
Mm-hmm.
So it was usually only when we were at a fire support base that, and they'd make an announcement that it was a Catholic Mass or a Protestant service, or, and it was much more rare for Jewish services, because I believe that, well, Jewish people make up a smaller part of the population.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, I think I remember seeing one rabbi. A lot of guys, Catholic or Protestant, used to go to either one of the services.
Mm-hmm.
Being close enough, you know, anything will do when you're mm-hmm. when you need this support. You know, I remember having, I still have some of that military stuff that I had, and it's all beat up and the like from being in my rucksack or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the military, you know, did their best to provide services, but, you know, you can only do so much in a war.
Right.
Like I said, I was very, very religious, and I saw people who normally who were not very religious be very religious.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, that was a religious issue, you know, for me and from what I saw.
Okay.
Anyway.
How did you reconcile as a strong Catholic there in your initial time in Vietnam and in your other tours with being in a war and seeing so much death and doing killing and having men killed beside you?
Well, my experience, you know, Catholicism is not a pacifistic Christian sect.
Right.
To kill in defense of somebody innocent or in defense of your own life is not considered a sin.
Mm-hmm.
Outright murder is. I mean, if you had a prisoner and he's unarmed and unresisting, you had him right there and you just shot him down,
mm-hmm.
Yes, the church would have considered that a murder. I had no problems. I'm not one that could murder. You know, without, I couldn't murder.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be a very, very, very unique situation. I couldn't cold-bloodedly murder.
Mm-hmm.
Like I explained once in assaults, if you're going forward and there's two North Vietnamese stand up in a trench with their arms up and you got more North Vietnamese you have to fight beyond them, you have no choice but to shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's got to keep going. One person stops to take prisoners,
mm-hmm.
that's less bullets going out, and that's a gap in the line.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's not murder. But like I said, if you have unarmed, unresisting, and you know you can take him prisoner and you just murder, just shoot them, that's murder.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not the kind of person that could just murder somebody. Sometimes I have these feelings that certain individuals in the world should be killed for the good of the herd, like Saddam Hussein
mm-hmm.
or somebody like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to get angry at somebody and to come out and kill them, no, that's not my ethics at all.
Mm-hmm.
Self-defense certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
I will admit, ever since I've gotten back, that I carry a knife.
Mm-hmm.
I use it for all kinds of things. But I also know, deep down, subconsciously, the reason I carry that knife is for a defensive weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I never run into a situation where I've had to use it, that's one of the old symbols of the old, that's one of the symptoms
mm-hmm.
Of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And most guys, the vast, vast majority of guys I know were not murderers. You do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple. There always are a few. I mean, our jails are filled with
mm-hmm.
people who commit murder, and you're going to get a couple of those bad apples in the bushel.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely wasn't respected, you know. Guys would kind of stand away from that. If it got out of hand, then somebody would talk to an officer
mm-hmm.
and say, you know, this is just too much. Even My Lai, that whole company did not participate in the murders.
Mm-hmm.
When the people in that large ditch were shot and killed, there were only four people who did the firing.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the troops, I mean, if you read the records and the like, the rest of the troops stood there kind of stunned
mm-hmm.
because they didn't normally do this kind of thing.
Right.
And didn't quite know what to do. They were given an order. Actually, they were given the order initially, and Kelly went off on a patrol, And they thought, he said to waste them, and they thought he was kind of kidding.
Right.
And they spent the next couple of hours actually interfacing with these people, playing with the kids. I mean, we always played with the kids. But sometimes we got these military chocolates, tropical chocolates. They didn't melt that easily, mm-hmm. and they weren't that good. We called them Gorilla Bars. Mm-hmm. But the kids, not having any or very little access to sugar, they loved them, you know. Mm-hmm. We're always playing with the kids and the like and kidding around with the... There were no young men there.
Mm-hmm.
Then these were families of Viet Cong, you know.
Right.
But still, I mean, you know, to kill them, just, mm-hmm. no, it doesn't make, we keep an eye on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we check them to make sure they weren't carrying any weapons or the like, because mm-hmm. some of them were a little radical, but, you know, once they're in custody,
mm-hmm.
no, I mean, it's just, it's unthinkable to me.
Yeah.
We interacted whenever I was in an area where there were civilians, and it wasn't all the time. Places like Dok To, you know, there's hardly anybody there. It's all primeval jungle,
mm-hmm.
Except for montagnards now and then. I mean, it was it was a lot of interaction, some trading, things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were some guys who were kind of bullying, or some guys who just didn't care or stop and think, as teenagers do, that what they're doing is offensive. You know, I mean, we have that, every society has that problem with teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Aristotle complained, or Socrates complained about teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Real pain in the ass. And I can see how the South Vietnamese civilians must have been a little nervous when you got these young men acting like that and they're all armed to the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really don't want to offend them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the South Vietnamese civilians would act very, very submissive until they saw that, you know, we weren't going to do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there always were a few people who were uncaring or unthinking, especially the young, and that's kind of common, actually.
Would those of you who didn't really participate in that or believe in that, would you try to restrain those around you who kind of...
I only saw one murder. I would classify it as a murder. Another one happened right after I left my first unit, and it happened by a guy that I wasn't surprised to hear about it. I think I told you about this guy that was going to kill our officer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, that was him. And after I left, they'd run into, I don't know, a one North Vietnamese or something, and they chased him down the trail, and these two guys captured him. And when you captured somebody, you got a three-day R&R. And the reason for that wasn't just so that you'd capture them,
right,
but that you'd be willing to take more of a risk, because you do have to take more of a risk sometimes,
mm-hmm.
to take them alive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're standing there kind of arguing, four North Vietnamese soldiers standing between them, arguing over who captured them and who gets the three-day R&R. So this guy that I was talking about just walks up and just shoots him in the chest.
Both of them?
Or no, one.
One soldier.
One North Vietnamese,
okay.
Yeah. The two guys arguing were Americans.
Okay.
And the other one I know of was a guy when I was in a helicopter on my second tour.
Did you hear about that or did you see it?
I heard about it afterwards.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But I wasn't surprised when they said who it was.
Right.
The second tour, we were doing a landing troops in rice paddies between two villages. And I was further back. I was maybe the fifth ship in a five-ship stick landing in this big open area. And this guy that didn't usually gun, he volunteered to be a gunner for the day. A lot of times they like to do that. If you can put in a certain number of hours, you get flight pay.
Mm-hmm.
But he was normally sort of a mechanic kind of guy. And normally I liked him. We landed... And where we landed, walking along Rice Paddy Dyke, was this, I don't know, probably 18, 19-year-old Vietnamese guy. And he's walking along, and all of a sudden these helicopters come out of the sky and land right next to him in a long line.
Mm-hmm.
And he's standing there kind of surprised, and this guy just lifted up his gun and gunned him down.
Hmm.
And I remember he was laughing about it and everything that night, and I wasn't impressed at all. Because, number one, who's to say this wasn't a South Vietnamese soldier on leave?
Right.
Number two, even if he was North Vietnamese or Viet Cong, we were discharging a whole company of infantry, and the first thing they would have done is checked him for ID and weapons and stuff like that, you know. And he just gunned the guy down. And I was further back in the ship, and we didn't fire. Usually when we come in the first wave, the gunners are firing in every direction. But since there were large villages on either side, we didn't. So you're always ready, your fingers on the trigger, waiting for it. And when he fired, the instinct just goes right down the line without even thinking, and you pull a trigger. And I was over one of the villages when the firing started up, when he fired, which caused everybody else to fire. And I fired probably 10, 15 rounds and stopped right away. I suddenly realized I was over the village. And I felt a little guilty about that, and I've always hoped that I never hit anybody. Because I didn't hear any rounds coming our way. That's a snap or a crack or a pop. And everybody else had stopped firing. And when we landed, I looked over towards the front, and I could see this guy lying on one side of this little rice paddy dike. I didn't know the exact situation. For all I knew, you know, he had a weapon or something that I didn't see, you know. So we dropped off the company, or part of it, went back, picked up the rest of the company, came in, and later on that night, the pilots were having a little party in their tent, and he was in there kind of laughing and boasting about it. A couple of guys were laughing with him, but everybody else just kind of ignored it. It was not considered, you know, a brave thing to do, or nobody really come out and took him to task for it. It was just kind of a turnoff. But those are the only two, I mean, off the top of my head, those are the only two murders I can think of. I have heard of a couple sort of like this first guy I was telling you about. But I also know that, you know, during all wars, it happens, unfortunately. I've even seen films from the Second World War. Snipers during the Second World War were considered very immoral. And I remember seeing films of snipers surrendering and then all the GIs just shooting them down. To us, a sniper was a fact of life in a guerrilla war. You know, so we didn't have that hatred, but during the Second World War, they did. And again, it's unfortunate. The North Vietnamese did it to us constantly. I mean, just constantly. Shoot prisoners, kill them. But generally, except for one reaction one time, after that company was wiped out in June 18th, 67. Generally, we got angry, but officers and sergeants made sure we didn't lose control of ourselves. So,
why do you think there's a big misconception about this idea of American atrocities in Vietnam, where you guys are running around, burning down every other village, shooting civilians?
Because the people don't realize why that was happening. I mean, to clear an area out so that the enemy can't get sustenance and sport and shelter and influence over the population is very important. And this has happened before in a lot of it. You just clear that area out. You move the people closer to where your forces are in your static positions, and you can deny the enemy a lot of the support and shelter, and they had to get a lot of their food and the like from it, and intelligence information. And you had to do it. And, you know, if you don't understand why, and if you've never really had your life in danger, you especially don't understand why, it looks cruel. The My Lai affair, oh, Jesus, what that did, you know, to guys like me, was just devastating, because all of us got identified with that. And it's like the North Vietnamese would do atrocities constantly. These throwing rockets indiscriminately into cities, murdering, you know, government officials, teachers, everything in villages. It's like the press just, well, you know, they're guerrillas. They're expected to do that. And that hurt, too, you know, because that was standard operating procedure for the communist terrorism, for most tyrannies, not just communists, but most tyrannies. And, you know, I get frustrated, but and I still get frustrated after all these years. Some guys can brush it off. I can't, because I guess I still feel, hear that echo of those times that things were said to me, and feeling it, it being just so very unfair, and very misunderstood. It's like friendly fire incidents. People just don't understand. But they don't stop and look when you get in your car and go out on the highway how many accidents take place.
Right.
And there's the press always has this tendency to, well, who's to blame for this? And somebody's got to be punished.
Mm-hmm.
But they just don't understand the situation. There's no, if there's gross negligence, you know, that's another matter. If a guy in the battery fire direction control was drunk back at the fire support base, and he put the rounds in the wrong place,
mm-hmm.
That's gross negligence.
Right.
And yes, he should go to prison for that. But if you know, you're pinned down by bullets and you know and you miss one number on that 6-digit or 8-digit coordinate, and the rounds come in and top you, I mean, you can't blame somebody for negligence.
Right.
Because things have to be done so quickly, and a lot of times you don't even know. They didn't have GPS systems.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm somewhere on this ridgeline, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they happen now, too.
Yes.
In Afghanistan, they've had some issues.
Mm-hmm.
But people just don't understand. And I sometimes, if I run into it, I may try and explain it, but generally, I look very much down my nose at people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I figure these are people that are ignorant and not stopping to think.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know. Yeah. I got 11:27 here.
Okay. Why don't we take a break for today, and we'll pick up another day.
Let me